I'm Darius Larson, and this is number 8 of a 10-part series on Genesis. And today we're taking a look at coming of age, Genesis 28 and 32. Primarily, we were looking at what is traditionally called Jacob's ladder and the wrestling match. And what we are really doing is taking a look, hopefully, at one and then the other, but how our conversations go. If something comes in your head and you want to just jump ahead to one, feel free to do that. I forgot what I was saying before, but I will just continue on here now. Yesterday we ended with Jacob having a blessing. The only problem with the blessing is that it was intended, we thought, supposed to be going to his brother Esau. And Jacob had to be somewhat devious, deceptive, along with his mother, to pull this act out. And that wonderful, beautiful phrase that when Isaac blesses Jacob, what we find out right after that is that this blessing makes Jacob a fugitive for about 20 years. He wanders and runs. If you think, what's his name, who starred in The Fugitive, had it rough, you should try being Jacob here with Esau. Has sworn to kill him, and we see later here that Esau has 400 men and is coming to meet him. So this is the scene. But I thought, because I don't know if it was clear in my head or in your heads, at least in our heads, what is blessing? I thought I would try, because it sets the stage for today too. I thought I would try one more crack at what is a blessing in the sense of a patriarchal blessing versus the type of blessing I do as a pastor when one blesses the congregation. In Genesis, it combines basically two things. It combines the primitive power of the spoken word, and believe me, that they believed that the word had power, that it's almost like today we say, what we dream, we become. If we can only dream it, we can become it. They said, if it can be spoken, it is in the sense of being spoken that it is created. And somebody afterwards said that the smallest particle that has been discovered so far in the cosmos is the sound wave. What? Hawking, I guess, said this. A sound wave. It's so small you cannot see it. You only know it exists. And then you think that God spoke and it was created as a different... You were the one who... Was it you who was telling me that? Did I say that right?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Stephen walking through my head, I don't know how much catches.
Yeah. How much is Stephen and how much is you? But be proud that I'm confusing the two of you. just to think it's not enough, but to speak it, the smallest particle, the sound wave, and creation happens. Blessing is a bit like that. Blessing is to speak it. Is a way of having it happen, having it become. The second part is there's a claim in this blessing to a special vocation for the one being blessed. The blessing sets you apart from another person, which is different than I say, may the Lord bless you and keep you. I mean, we can say that to all people. But in Genesis, blessing is a calling, is a setting apart, that when one father passes the blessing on to another child, it separates that child from the other children. And It is life-changing. One is never the same again after the blessing. It is world-transforming. The world is never the same. Because the blessing, when given, what is given is the essence of who you are. A blessing defines who you are. Therefore, it's very dangerous and it's very compelling. It is intergenerational in the sense that I, as the Father, connects in a very awesome way with the next generation, the Son. I pass down the tradition. I pass over to the next generation. What it is that's the essence of our family. And now it's your job, your responsibility to carry that essence forward. Remember in this worldview that symbolic actions have power and spoken words shape life. Words create worlds. It's kind of dreams put into words. So the punchline of all this, well, there's two punchlines. One, there is pathos, that to have that special blessing for me means that the rest of you are not blessed in that same way, at least. It is unique, it is particular. And with the sign of the birthright and stuff, what we're talking about, you can only give that blessing to one person. That, well, there's only one person, for some reason, the tradition has it, that one person carries on that dream, that essence, and you know, other people can carry on, they have other blessings. But this is the unique, the patriarchal blessing. And therefore, a blessing in words and gestures bind a person's life to a precious past, where we have been, to the promise of a future where we are going. And so the blessings that we discover in Genesis connect us with the past and move us towards the future, and we're caught right in the middle of that. It's almost like the word righteousness. I remember a person trying to fix his car in Israel. And as he was trying to putz around with his car and stuff, he was fumbling around with this thing, probably adjusting the carburetor, and just when he pulled back, stopped, he slammed the hood down, and then not out of frustration, but I could just see a gleam in his eyes, and I forgot the word right now, he said something in Hebrew. And I asked him what it meant. And he says, well, I guess we would translate that word righteousness. My car is acting the way it is supposed to act. Good definition of righteousness. The good definition of blessing when received is that person who takes on that blessing becomes righteous, is called to be what God intends that person to be. So it is vocational in its highest point. The blessing is essential to the patriarchs, as the sea is to fish, as birds, as air is to birds, as breath is to life. A patriarch has no reason for being without the blessing, because the blessing defines who they are. Now, Jacob, the impostor, has been blessed. And the trouble with Jacob is he's struggling with, who is it that was blessed? Is it me, Jacob? Is it me, Jacob, the impostor, or is it Esau, who I pretended to be? And so he is struggling with this, and as I said earlier, he is now a fugitive and is wandering around, and we pick the story up now, 20 years of running around, And let's listen to the story. And if you want to pick it up, it's part of 28. It starts with chapter 28, verse 10.
This Jacob was on the run. He had stolen the blessing from his father meant for Esau, and Esau had vowed to kill him. Now Jacob was alone at night, and he took a stone and made a pillow on which he could sleep. And Jacob dreamed he saw a ladder that reached from earth to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. Suddenly God stood right in front of Jacob and spoke to him. I am with you, God said, and I will not leave you. You will have land and a nation of people. When Jacob awoke, he was shaken in awe of God. This was a holy place. He took the stones on which he had slept and made a pillar. And he said, if God does all that God says and provides food for me in future generations, and if I return to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. 20 years passed, and Jacob was an older man. He decided to return to the land of his father and to face his brother Esau for the first time since Jacob had tricked him out of his blessing. On the way, he heard his brother Esau was coming to meet him with 400 men, and Jacob prayed. He prayed to God that Esau wouldn't destroy him and his children. Jacob sent his wives and servants to the other side of the river. He stayed alone. It was night, and Jacob wrestled with the stranger until the break of day. When his adversary couldn't prevail, he wrenched Jacob's hip from its socket. Let me go, the man said. The day is breaking. And Jacob said, I won't let you go unless you bless me. What is your name? The stranger asked. And he answered, Jacob. Your name shall no longer be Jacob. You shall be called Israel. You have wrestled with God and man and have prevailed. Jacob named the place of the blessing Peniel, which means I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been saved. But Jacob lived forever after. As the sun rose, Jacob looked up and he saw Esau coming. Esau ran to greet him and he fell on Jacob's neck and he kissed him. And the brothers wept.
One correction, the story of what we call Jacob's ladder did not occur 20 years later. It was somewhere in the midst of his fugitive state. It's the wrestling with this 20 years later.
As we started out before, anything as you listen to it, any thoughts that just pop out of your mind that you see unique, different? Yes?
I hadn't heard before that he says, if you do these things for me, God, you'll be my God. Uh-huh. I mean, that was a conditional acceptance of...
Yes, or it could be... If these things are true, then you are my God. But it does say a little clear, you know, what you're saying is what I think the text is saying. I don't want to interpret. You should be playing the devil's advocate here. Now I'm defending in the other sense. But it could have two interpretations, but it's definitely clear that you could interpret it conditionally. And if you do this, then you'll be my God. Or it could mean, if this is all true, then you are my God. It doesn't state it as clearly as that, but it could be. Any other thoughts?
Don't you think that anybody who seeks out a stone for a pillow is liable to have a hard night?
especially a pillow that you then turn upright afterwards and it becomes a pillar. those were the days, my friends. I thought they'd never end.
Yeah. The other thing is that there's a culmination at the end of the story that we heard, in that he has now been blessed twice. He has raged against man and God, and now he is blessed.
Yeah. Definitely. And we'll be definitely getting into that point too. So I'm going to be quiet.
let's take a look and let's try to separate our conversation, and I'm going to try to watch the time here between the these two wonderful, wonderful stories here. And we start with in chapter 28, verse 10. What do you expect when you or you think somebody else has a religious experience? Where do you expect religious experiences to occur?
Anywhere.
Religious experience, in my mind, can happen wherever you are or wherever you God speaks to you. It can be out in the nature, and it can be in church, which is a common place where you worship and feel the Holy Spirit moving. But mostly, well, a lot of it, sometimes you can have a very clear religious experience of God speaking to you when you're outside in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I find it very interesting in these opening verses here, 10 and 11. It says, he came to a certain place and stayed there that night. It's not a place that's named at all. It's a place, but it's not. I don't think he was expecting this place. Or in fact, he wasn't expecting this place to be a place where a religious experience would happen. In fact, it would probably be the last thing on his mind because this place was on the boundaries. It was on the edge. It was out there on the border of the promised land. This event happens between places. And I think that many religious experiences happen when we don't expect them to happen. And when we expect them to happen, they probably won't happen. If we could be just kind of be attuned and open to them wherever they are, whether they be in the churches, whether they be in the mountains, Here, Jacob wasn't attuned, but he just saw all of a sudden something happens. And I think the startling thing here is that it's not that God appears. I mean, I think we believe that God appears, and God's appeared to many different people in various times and places. But God appears to the scoundrel, Jacob. This deceiving, conniving person, this exiled one in such a decisive way. And it happens in what? A dream. And what is this dream? What do you see here? Okay, Jacob is now asleep. And Jacob sees what?
The Lord stood beside him.
A dream that there was a ladder, some translations say a ramp, a staircase. If I was translating, I would say escalator. I don't know how far it is, but I have this vision of an up and down escalator with all these angels, you know, going and going back and forth, up and down. And not only were there angels, but then all of a sudden in this dream, as he's seeing these angels going around and around and around and around, the Lord, Yahweh, God's self, is standing next to Jacob. And what does the Lord say? First part of it is pretty similar to other things. I'm the Lord, the God of Abraham, the father and God of Isaac. Well, no doubt about this dream who's here. You know, sometimes it's a little more ambiguous than that. You know, you just wonder what's going on here. Let me just tell you, beyond a shadow of a doubt, this is who I am. Unlike the wrestling match, who you're not quite sure who this man is, this stranger that's just all shadowy and maybe only the shadow knows. In this one, it's very, 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 very obvious that it is the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land of which you lie, I give to you, da-da, da-da, da-da. This whole blessing, this whole purpose of why you are here, this is all the same, no matter which patriarch hears it, this is the same dream. But we're connecting now with the God of the past. And then in 28:15, it gets a little bit different. it starts getting very personal to this particular person. And three things are said. Yes?
I was going to say with the God of Abraham, wasn't in Genesis 12 that Abraham, the Lord talked to him at Haran.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going back. So, I mean, it's kind of a repetition a little bit of the Abraham call story. And he's going back towards the place where Revelation is at.
It's definitely a repetition, and it's repetition because of that precise point that this God, remember now, I haven't even said this, remember now, part of what all Genesis is primarily a battle between to stake a claim on monotheism. That in this world, everybody thinks there's a God who does this, 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 but the God of Israel is Yahweh. One God. And it is this one God who has been with us since the beginning of time. So it's this, and that's why the second creation account, those of you who didn't hear that, you can listen, there's two creation accounts, that's tape one. The second creation account has to make that connection that it is Yahweh who creates all that there is. And then now we're connecting Jacob, the new patriarch, needs to be connected with the first patriarch. So you get a repetition, a time and a time and time again. This is almost old hat, and thank you for stopping. I almost jumped over that because I assumed it was old hat. We know this stuff. We've been there. And now we're on verse 15, and this is stuff that we don't know. This is new. This is now, what about Jacob in particular? He has some particular needs here. And this God is speaking to him, and he says basically three things. What's the number one thing?
I am with you.
Know that I am with you. And second?
He will keep you.
And he will keep you wherever you go. And the third?
Bring you back.
And will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised. Wow. I don't know about you, but I would think I would like a dream like this. This is quite a dream. I mean, here I've been running around trying to get this blessing this way and this way, conniving and everything else, trying to do everything myself. And then all of a sudden I have this dream where I am just hiding for my life. And God says, I'm with you, Darius. It's okay. Not only if I'm with you, I will keep you in my presence. And I will bring you back to the land. And that was what it's all about. What you have in these three, in this one verse here, the three promises of the presence of God, the promise of God, and the wonderful homecoming. The homecoming that I will bring you back. This dream has incredible visual imagery. You can just see, like I say, the escalators. You can see God appearing. But the important part of this dream is not so much its visual imagery, as much as the audio, the words that were spoken here. It is the speech of God which changes things here. Once again, words have a way of creating reality in this ancient world. Some preachers still think it does.
And what you said about Genesis being a claim to monotheism, you could also make the claim that it's also a claim to the land.
Oh. Definitely a claim to land. Walter Brueggemann, in a book years ago called The Land, says that if you want to see a crucifixion happen again, what you say is to the Israeli government that you have to give up your dream of the land. The land, and he talks about landed people are fat cats, they become insensitive, they no longer see the needs of the poor and all this sort of thing, that there's a case that the Jewish people, for right or wrong,
should always be longing for it and never attaining it. That it is in the longing, it is in the questing. C.S. Lewis says, heaven's a mountain without a top. It is in the struggle. It is in the longing that you discover. And back here, it's easy to do that because you don't have the land. What happens when you get the land? You know, then you have a whole other cast of problems. But I would say it is. Well, it's three things. It's progeny. It's the need to have descendants being very fruitful and multiplying all over the place and growing, because that's what life is all about. That's what eternal life back here is all about, is that life continues through your descendants. There is no mention of eternal life in Genesis. Eternal life basically is, I will carry on through my descendants. It's the gift of the land, and then also, yes.
Well, the third promise, I will not leave you until I give you what I promised I would give you.
Yeah.
Which is the land.
Which is the land. That is the promise. And we notice that, I'll jump ahead to tomorrow, we leave Genesis without that promise being fulfilled yet. It is the beginning and the end, and we go all the way through 50 chapters of Genesis, and we got to enter Exodus, which is next year probably. Yes?
Before you get too far ahead, I
want
to sympathize with you for the lightning bolt that's going to get you in your bed tonight.
Okay.
You called Jacob a scoundrel.
Uh-huh.
And if we go back to 27:29, cursed be whoever curses you. The point I want to make is, I don't think he was now. He got the blessing. No matter how it happened, that is the blessing, and he's essentially been wiped clean from that point. That really, the blessing does have some special significance. Now, I think that God then, at Haran, affirmed the blessing. Jacob was probably walking around wondering, well, was that really real because I connived to get it? And God, in the first part, repeated the Abraham blessing and to tell him, yes, don't worry about your own doubts. It really was real, and he extended it. But I don't think we should look at him throughout his life as being somebody that won it by deceit. That happened in his history. It was a seed that was planted. He had to deal with the fruits later on with Joseph and his brothers. But he himself was not in any sense tinged through his life by that, I don't think.
Yeah, that's true. But in the sense that we are all scoundrels as well. Because if the chapters we're not dealing with, in between, which ones are we dealing with? 28 and 32, we have him getting a wife and stealing a lot of money from his father-in-law or possessions and all these sorts of things, and he's not a nice guy yet. In fact, here's my punchline for the whole thing. Jacob is a deceiver until that final wrestling match when Jacob dies and Israel, which is what he's renamed, is born. That's when the blessing really happens. The blessing happens, it takes root. His essence is discovered in that wrestling match. Now, parts of it, you know, and you can have your interpretation, I can have mine, and we'll see if the lightning bolt hits either of us. but it is the hope for the new in the midst of the old, which I see Jacob in that sense as the first real person of hope and possibility. That no matter what in our lives, there can be turning around, there can be newness, there can be change. And how this unfolds are these stories. So once we get there, if you want to come back to that, come back to that. Yes?
Can we also say that he, as it was for ourselves, he tried to make something happen that he felt he wanted by his own methods.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't wait upon God, who later did come to him in a dream and give him a blessing when he became Israel. So to me, that's a lesson that we make that mistake all the time.
But we only make it in hindsight. I think every class for 9 classes now, that point has been brought up, and it's a very valid point. But the point is, what are we supposed to do then? Are we all supposed to be just zombies? We have to kind of
discern and try to think that we know. Now, whether Jacob's thinking he's discerning what God wants or if he's discerning what he thinks he wants is an interesting question. Yeah.
I like what he's saying.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm looking at God from a 20th century viewpoint, and I know God is a forgiving God.
Mm-hmm.
And God would have, as I believe, forgiven Jacob and Rebekah immediately and understood. And there would have been that forgiveness. The problem is that man does not forget and forgive. And so we continue to label, we continue to put people down because they have made a mistake in the past. And God is much more gracious than we are.
Couldn't agree with you more, but the question I heard is, when does Jacob realize that? And does Jacob realize that right after the blessing, or does Jacob realize that after the wrestling, or during the wrestling match? I'm holding out it's during the wrestling match. That's the discovery. And I've heard you saying that it came earlier.
No, other people might be in agreement with that. I'm saying that blessing is what it says, but that others and Jacob himself probably had trouble accepting it.
That you're right, yes. Right. And we don't know what Esau's thinking, but we know what Jacob thinks Esau is thinking.
We know a little bit of what Esau thinks, because now he realizes that his wives had not pleased Rebekah and Isaac, and so he tries to change things and marries one of Ishmael's daughters.
That's true. Do you, if you want to read the chapters in between, it's a far, us talking about family values, biblical family values. If you read the book of Genesis, you have this, one wife, two wives, three wives, a couple maidservants, as we translate it, which we know what that is with Hagar, basically slave girls that are having all these kids. That's hard to sort out, but of course that's 20th century eyes now versus wherever we are here now.
Not only 20th century, but from the viewpoint of the New Testament too.
That's true too. Yep. Okay, we have the dream. God is saying that this is the God that promised everything to Abraham. I'm promising all this to you in case you don't get this yet, Jacob. And the other thing I'm promising you, I am with you, I will be with you, and you will come home to the land. So, Jacob wakes up. I find that fascinating. Jacob wakes up. The dream, the vision, God speaking was a dream. But what Jacob does with the dream is in present time, in real time. Jacob decides to act upon the dream that Jacob had. And we say, oh, it's just dreams, have any of you had any powerful, life-changing dreams? When you have those, you're not quite the same anymore. I sometimes think I'm walking in a dream, so maybe I'm going to say I've never had those dreams. But yes, I have, but they're different kind of dreams than this kind of dream, so maybe I have. But they're so life-changing. You are never the same again. And lots of people dream these things, it's just a dream. Jacob woke up, which means another euphemism. I got it. I woke up. This is what this is all about. So what does Jacob do here when he wakes up? He builds an altar.
Worship God.
This is a holy spot. There's something happened here that has the power of the transcendence. I'm going to do something here. I'm going to make this place a a holy spot. Then after that, Jacob travels, meets Rachel, marries Laban's daughters, and they have lots of kids, and they prosper at their father-in-law's expense. And now, well, I just went through a couple chapters there. Now, we are on chapter 32, verse 1.
Unholy spot.
What?
Unholy spot. It wasn't that it wasn't holy before. It was in his recognizing that it was holy.
That's true.
You know, if God makes everything and it is good, and God declares it good and blessed, that everything is holy. But he has, out of all of his wanderings, come across this place that has touched his life, and now he knows that this is a holy place.
One of the best, I mean, there's tons of great Luther quotes, but one of the best Luther quotes that I know is something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing it, is that God is present everywhere. God is as present in my cabbage soup as God is present in the body and blood of our Lord Jesus in that bread and that wine that's on the altar. But God has remained hidden in the cabbage soup, but has chosen to reveal God's self in the Blessed Sacrament. God is as present in this place as God is present in any place. But God chooses to reveal God's self to Jacob in this place, and then we wake up. We get it. Good point. Yeah, yeah. This did not become holy because of that. We recognized it was a holy spot, and that could be the same for anywhere we walk if we had eyes to see. Or ears to hear.
I think you're skipping an insidious foreshadowing of
modern
Christianity. The end of the story about the dream.
Yes.
Jacob essentially restates God's words, but you notice he puts in comfort. God said, I'll take care of you, I'll protect you, and I'll bring you back. Jacob says it again and says, would you throw in food and clothes too, please, God?
Yeah.
Isn't that very telling of modern day Christianity too, is, yes, God, you are God, but don't make it too uncomfortable for us along the way.
Yeah, that could very well be, and we do have a way of wanting to interpret our dreams. I mean, let me put it this way. One of the wonderful things about Genesis 1 and 2 is the whole thing about being created in the image of God. And all too often, what I think our sin is that we want to create God in our image. We want to add the clothes. We want to add this. And how do we suspend our own judgment, which is hard to do, because then what do we know about who this God is without our judgment? But how am I created in the image of God, which is what Jacob now, I think, is trying to relinquish himself to do, versus to create God in my own image, which means whatever I can grasp, whatever I can get, wherever I am, that's that, you know, I'm in control. I'm in control of this. And pretty soon, Jacob is discovering that he's not in control, and he's got to let the control. However, having said that, he's still feisty and he still wants to fight. And that's where we are here, and we better.
Is that
yes?
Why when he says surely this the Lord is in this place and I didn't know it, did he expect you would know it?
I don't think he expected to know it. I think he had to be hit over the head with a sledgehammer myself. But
so this was the I didn't know it.
Yeah, that was the rock he slept on. He rolled over and the rock came with a bang.
And I didn't know it.
No.
I'm so smart, I should have known it. Or, whoa, I didn't even know it.
Or, here I am running around as a fugitive, thinking that I have to do this all by myself, running, just fearing for my life. And I didn't know that God was with me all this time. That God was actually walking with me all this time. That God was present with me. I mean, if this place is holy because I finally recognized it, but last year, I probably could have recognized it. God was with me then, too. It's maybe a little bit like
footprints in the sand, Paul.
You wake up and you say, yeah, God is here. I knew we'd never get to the other one, but yes, go ahead.
Isn't it interesting that in relation to what you were saying is that at the end of the story, Jacob limps. That is a sort of godlike thing for...
In godliness?
I want to be like God because I want to be in control situation for Jacob's escape. There is that struggle that goes on to be godlike. And yet, there's always that that makes us limp. And I think it's a good thing that we do limp.
What we have set up for that limp is that Jacob now understands, I think, what he's supposed to be about to be a patriarch. Jacob understands that he has to make amends with Esau.
So he sends out a messenger to Esau to say, I'm coming home. But the messenger comes back and says, you wouldn't believe this. Esau's coming to see you. As you're coming to see him. Isn't that wonderful? Oh, by the way, he's got 400 men and they're heavily armed. I can just see Jacob go, oh no. He's really out to get me. Here it is. What am I going to do? So he gets all worried and he divides his family, his possessions, his everything up, so that if one gets destroyed, at least some continue to live. And by the way, the dividing them into two camps. Some people make a big deal out of the two camps, because what Jacob has to do now is to be reconciled to two camps, figuratively and literally, God and Esau. So he is about to go into battle with two, God and Esau. So they all go across the river, no problem there. The river, another boundary, crossing over, and he stays alone. Have you ever been alone? Have you ever felt alone? Can you imagine what it would feel like? You know, this guy, he's made some money, he's got some camels, he's got lots of people, lots of kids, and all this sort of stuff. And I think he's starting to feel that he can trust God, but he still's got to trust his wits too. I mean, prayer does not replace common sense. I mean, and Jacob's got some common sense here. He's sensing that something's about to happen here now, and there are 400 men who are coming with my brother who I have connived and cheated against. And they just may be out to get me here. So, sends him around, and by the way, Shakespeare, in almost all of his tragedies, all of his plays, at least, has this pre-battle sequence of dreams. He got here. It wasn't original with William Shakespeare. So he is now. Oh, where am I? What verse are we on here? We're right at the start.
So is he still acting like a scoundrel here?
I don't know if he's acting like a scoundrel, but I think for the first time he is, well, maybe not the first time, but he is at least acting scared out of his wits, and he's really in need of God's help here. And he's realizing that he can't do it by himself. He's opening himself up to some sort of divine intervention, I think, here, because sometimes we get that way when we're scared. You know, prayer should be the first stance, not the last words, but so often it's the last words. We try everything else, then we pray.
However, if I was one of those women or children that he sent ahead, you know, there would be a little bit of scoundrel thinking in those camps.
You go this way, I stay here.
And make sure that when you go and meet my brother, just, you know, give him all these gifts, appease him, and maybe he won't kill you, and, you know. But he doesn't do it just once, he does it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's in the back.
I think afraid, we continue to try and manipulate the situation.
Yeah, he's setting it up like an army.
He can't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's an army going into war, where you put out your first and your second group.
And what,
the
what
stays in the background?
Yeah. And once again, this is high drama here that we're setting up. But once again, these stories evolved from describing what has happened and trying to understand how God has been at work in this. It's not prescribing how things will happen. It's looking back versus looking forward. And with that, we weave different things into these stories.
Yeah, there's an aspect to this which we're just letting go, and go. Maybe it's just as well for the sake of the story, but if I were in his spot and I thought that my big brother, my big hairy brother with their troops were going to come after me, from a rhetorical point of view, first thing I would evoke would, dear old mom, you know, what's his name, Wilson, the devil made me do it. Mom, remember mom. This was mom's idea. And we've just forgotten her now. But I don't think this fellow thought it up.
You know, that's very interesting. And I would say, if what you're saying is true, I would say Jacob ceases to be a scoundrel at that point. Because what Jacob is doing, when I've been teaching all these pre-history stories, we're always so quick to blame and not take responsibility. You know, Eve made me do it. The serpent made me do it. We just never own up for it. We asked last week, what would have been different if one of those characters would have said, yes, I killed Abel. But we just always avoid responsibility. Maybe here,
he takes
responsibility. Yes?
Well, I've had an experience in my life where I really likened it to wrestling, you know, with an angel of the Lord. And it's something that match took place over a long, many, many, many days and nights, and waking up in the middle of the night thinking, I've got the answer. And then you think about it in your conscious state and say, oh, no, that's not going to work. And it's like you feel, oh, I got free. And then you're pinned again. And you're pinned. And you're looking for a way out that's easy and simple. And imagining all these things that everyone's talking about. Well, can I blame it on mom? Maybe I can trade back part of my birthright. Maybe I can give half of my household, maybe all of it. What are my options? And he's going through all these things where he can fulfill the promise that God has shown him, but yet he wants to make it easy. And there's this struggle going on inside of him because he realizes that now his back's against the wall and he's got no place to go and he's looking for a way out and he's wrestling and fighting and struggling within himself for a way out.
Reminds me of John of the Cross, the dark night of the soul. We people who have that dark night of the soul, that's what's going on here. He's alone, and when he's alone, this man appears. One translator, which I like a lot better, the hidden one appears. You don't know at this point what this thing is. Is it Jake? Is it Esau? Is it God? Is it Satan or some evil thing? We don't know who this is, but it is the hidden one who starts wrestling. Later we discover that it's God.
and you're wrestling, and you can't make out the shapes. Mysteriously, they kind of weave together, and as they're wrestling, is it who's on top, who's underneath? Have you watched wrestlers? I mean, they're not only just in each other's face, they're in each other's bodies. I mean, they're just together. And is this happening at night? Any reasons why it might happen at night?
So they couldn't see who the aggressor
was. Probably couldn't see. A lot of people think that I have to leave because it's daybreak. I have to get out of here. This voice, you know, it's one of the conversations. Somebody says, because it's this mysterious power that only has power at night. You know, we've heard all these vampire stories and all these other sorts of things. It could be that. Or it could be that this hidden one needs to remain hidden. For one who sees the face of God will not live. So you gotta stay hidden here. So you're wrestling, and it could be also because that's when dreams come. That's when you have time to when aloneness is most frightening, and all these sorts of things. Who knows? But as they wrestle, we gotta move quickly here now. What we see is this wonderful dialogue. Right now the match is pretty even. I mean, if nothing else, wrestled all night means they wrestled for a long time. Maybe not as long as your wrestling match. But this was a long, exhausting, sweaty night. And then this remarkable dialogue in 26 to 29 after this exhausting conflict. After the physical battle, they're reduced to speech. And I know that I have been known to wrestle with my son and just keep rolling around. Pretty soon we're exhausted enough that we just kind of lay there, and then we start talking. Some of the times we can really talk. And this is, or you can see these two wrestlers, just they're still entangled, and they don't know who's on top, who's on bottom, who's off the mat, who's on the mat, but they're just, no one wants to move. They start talking to each other. I don't know if you've ever wrestled. I can feel this point. The hidden one says, "What? Let me go, for the day is breaking." And Jacob says, "I will not let you go, unless you what?
Bless.
Unless you bless me." Jacob is a little bit stronger here. It's almost like that first time, his first wrestling match in the womb of Rebecca. Here they're wrestling, trying to get out first, and Jacob says, "I will not let you go. I will hold on to your heel." That's why he gets the name. He holds on to that heel and goes through that birth channel. I think this is a metaphor too to another birth channel. Here, we want to talk about a born again experience. It's about to happen right here. "I will not let you go until you bless me." Same thing that happened, I think, with Jacob and Esau on that first birth experience. The hidden one ignores the request, at least for a moment, and says what? "What is your name?" I'll translate his name. "The deceiving one." That's what Jacob means. The deceptive one. The scoundrel. "My name's Jacob. You shall no longer be called the scoundrel, the deceptive one, the rotten one, the whatever other euphemism, the one who holds on to the heel one." You're such a heel. Wonder where that came from. Huh? Might be related here. "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed."
How can you prevail with God?
I was thinking this, I was about to ask, how could anybody prevail with God? Now, you got an answer?
Yeah.
No.
I get the same question.
God,
is that him? But just so you don't prevail too much, zap! I guess you could do it if you wanted to.
Oh,
well, okay, I'll say I won this match. I mean, I don't know. Anybody else got any other ideas? Yes.
I think it was sort of a blessing because he can't run.
Interesting.
He can no longer run away. He's been running for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
He can't run anymore.
Yeah.
We were meant to hobble.
It reminds me of the parable of the one who keeps asking, insisting, with the householder until finally the householder says, yes, we have what you asked.
Uh-huh. Do you know what the word Israel means? The one who strives with God? Is that what you said? The one who wrestles with God? The one who, or some people, it's an ambiguous, I love it because nobody agrees with what it means, which means it must mean something. Because we don't, a lot of times, the name, we don't know what it means until the first one who has it, whoever they are, that's what it is. I mean, that's why we have all these cute names. It seems just to fit the character of the person. They're the first ones with it. And we don't know what Israel means yet. Some people have said it means God rules, God preserves, God protects. And some say, one who is always in God's face demanding.
Yeah.
What does Israel mean? All I know what happens in this case when there's a name change, we said before there's an elevation of status, but I think there's also something else going on here, is that a new being is being called forth. If we want a born again experience found somewhere other than in the New Testament, we can definitely say this is one of them. Power has shifted now. Israel is a newness which has prevailed with God. And then Israel/Jacob says, by the way, what is your name? The presumption of this character, the gutsiness of this character. Why is it that you ask my name?
If you were the same group that started with me, I would have gone back to the tree of knowledge.
Do you really want to know good and evil? Do you really want to know the essence of, because when you know a person's name, you know their essence, you know who they are. You have some power over them. That's why the word Yahweh is always written without the vowel, so you never speak the name. So how do you say it without the vowels? Formerly known as Yahweh. Prince. That's the joke. We don't know who I was talking about.
And then he blesses him.
And then he blesses him. I'm going to not tell you everything about who I am. The rest of the story continues. But I will give you now what you first asked for, now that you're not asking for it. I will bless you.
Sans deception.
It's what?
Sans deception.
Mm-hmm. The name of God, though, is not given. The blessing that Jacob so craved is given, and God remains God. Jacob is no longer Israel. He is no longer Jacob, but Israel. So at daylight, who's gone? What happens at daylight? Who disappears? The hidden one. And who else? This is a trick question. Jacob is gone. Israel remains. Jacob is no, even though we still refer to him as Jacob because we're not used to that name yet. But literally, I think, is gone. And we're out of time. And what we do is now that he's Israel, he comes and he sees Esau, and remember what happens?
They
embraced and they wept. How many siblings do you know that you would just love that to happen? This is a story about reconciliation, and if we had more time to talk about it, it's a powerful image of reconciliation after everything that has gone wrong. You talk about the prodigal son return. Here it is in this story, too.
20 wasted years.
Yeah, or maybe not wasted, maybe he needed those 20. He got a few children, a few wives, and you know, but that relationship. And sometimes people in crisis and in conflict, when they reconcile, are much closer than people who have just always assumed it.